Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. Special thanks to WKDZ, your Ag Edge network, for their help in bringing you this show. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will visit with Dr. Jonathan Larson, UK Extension Entomologist, to discuss this week's topic, insect issues from 2021 and his predictions for what insects will be like in 2022. And as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm doing good. Vicki, yourself?
I'm doing well. Can't complain.
David, how about you?
I'm getting along, Jay.
Good. We're at a remote location, I guess you could say, today.
We're on the move.
We're on assignment. We have moved down to the Christian County Extension office today, my old stomping grounds, to set up and do this recording. This office was the host site for this year's IPM update and training. And that's how we were able to capture some of these specialists all together at one time. So with us today is UK Extension Entomologist, Dr. Jonathan Larson. Jonathan, glad to have you here.
I'm very happy to be here. I'm glad to see that you're agile and mobile and hostile, ready to go.
Oh,
Kentucky,
yeah,
exactly.
We do. Now, he's hostile.
I'm the one that tries to keep these two, grounded.
Yeah, I'm feeling out the personalities here on the show.
There's a reason she sits between us.
Okay.
Now, we're glad to have you here with us and taking part in what we feel like is a new and innovative way to reach out to producers and consumers and try to meet them on the grounds where they want to meet. So we're happy you could be with us today.
I appreciate the invitation. Happy to talk bugs anywhere, anytime.
But, along those lines, let's talk bugs. We've kind of got that topic of what we'd like to talk about this week. So talk a little bit about some of the things that you saw last year during 2021, and then we'll move on into predictions for the next year.
That's when I get the crystal ball out, is later in the show.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, just keep it in your bag.
The tarot cards, later. Maybe.
We're going to hold that till the end.
Okay, cool. The witchcraft goes at the end. So as an extension entomologist, I'm very privileged. I get to hear from all the different agents across the state. I get to hear from the public about the insects that are kind of plaguing their plants or causing them the most issues. And I like to kind of catalog that data just to see who's sort of the blue ribbon bug and who won the year. And we have expectations every year of what we think will be sort of the big pest. We try to make those kinds of evaluations and predictions. But as you know, it can be difficult to do. So when I was going into 2021, I was definitely excited for the Brood X periodical cicada emergence. I really expected that to be the sort of number one insect news story. It is something that impacts ag, of course, particularly those of us who have nurseries where we grow trees or orchard owners. Those insects, they do lay their eggs in those trees and cause some small damage. They also can annoy quite a few people. The male is known for their song. I don't know if any of you are big fans of cicada jam music.
I was actually hoping that I would hear more, but where I was, it just wasn't a lot of activity, or I wasn't listening at the right time. But
did you see that, Jonathan? Did you see it happening in different parts of the state, or how did it kind of?
So yeah, the cicadas here in the state of Kentucky. Kentucky does have multiple broods that live here. So when we talk about a brood of cicadas, we're talking about the groups that emerge in set years. So they're either on a 13 or 17 year cycle, and Brood X, which means Brood 10. They were the ones that were set to come out last year. And their map in Kentucky used to be very widespread. They used to have a lot of counties that covered most of the state. We've seen some local extinctions, it seems like. Certain groups don't come out anymore. And the last time this happened in 2004, I think there were only about 12 or 13 counties that reported them. And they were only along the Ohio River, kind of in the central and eastern portion of the state, with a couple of spotty bits out west. But this past year, we were able to use this app called Cicada Safari that was from a university in Ohio, Mount St. Joseph, and we were able to recruit people to report sightings on there, and we ended up getting a ton of data. It was really cool. They sent us a map recently that showed just where they found them in Kentucky, and a lot of the counties we thought didn't have them anymore, it turned out that they were still there, just maybe in smaller pockets. I wrote down some of the western-ish counties that we did get reports from. So we had Trigg, Simpson, Allen, Warren, Ohio, McLean, Hancock, Davies, and Breckenridge County all reported seeing at least a few cicadas in those spots. I apologize if I mispronounced any of the county names.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay.
It was close.
Yeah. Which one did I get wrong?
It's McLean.
Oh, God.
That's the county.
Some sort
I
of
mean.
Pronunciation.
Yeah. David's actually the ag agent in McLean County.
Yeah. And they're quick to correct.
Yeah.
Too,
that's what I'm sure. Yeah. I say Louisville right. I know that much.
There you go.
That's that puts you a step ahead you learn how to say that. Yeah.
David, they're quick to correct you if you misspell it too.
Absolutely.
You remember that?
I do. I remember that vividly.
So. Side joke.
Well, hey, I like Kentucky jokes.
Well, Webster wasn't on the list, so I'm glad I just didn't miss that. But
that doesn't mean you don't have them there somewhere. I mean, you could have some of the other broods that may live in your county. Particularly, I know out here there's a 13-year brood that's quite strong, brood 23 or XXIII. That was big in 2015. I've seen some of the maps that came out then for that one. It won't be back around until 2038, I think, if I do the math correctly on that one. There's a lot of them here kind of overlapping and mixing. Kentucky seems like the boundary waters for a lot of these cicada broods.
I think they're interesting creatures.
Oh, they're beautiful. They're wonderful. I was very excited for them. This was what I was really pumped about. I was ready to do all kinds of media blitzes and infographics and podcasts about it and make jokes about how when the male is singing, it sounds like Marvin Gaye to the females because that's how they recruit each other to these trees. But it wasn't quite the story breaker that we had thought it would be because there were these other bugs that ended up popping up. So we did get to talk about it a lot. We saw some damage, especially in places like Louisville, a lot of the counties up towards Cincinnati. I was told that you could drive down the highway at like 80 miles an hour and you couldn't hear your own radio.
Now, I did hear that. Yeah. I'd heard some folks talk about that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that it was very loud up there. I did get to go to Louisville and catch quite a few. I was on a TV show called Wild Fed, and the guy ate the cicadas as part of the show. It was actually pretty delicious. He had a chef do it. I thought we were just going to like eat them raw, like sushi in the field or something after we caught them. But he'd hired a local chef, and we went to this farm, and we ate them together. They were cooked in like mulberry glaze. It was all foraged materials. That's his big thing is how to get people back to where food comes from, like how we connect with agriculture, how we connect with wild food. And so that was exciting. But we ended up talking more about a few other bugs. I'm guessing you've all heard about the spotted lanternfly problems that have happened in other parts. So what do you know about spotted lanternfly, if I could ask?
You know, you were part of our A&R update, both in the West and the East, I believe. And you talked extensively about it then, I think the kid was from Kansas that discovered this.
That's true. Yeah. There was a find in Kansas, supposedly, by a 4-H student who was making an entomology collection, which makes my heart swell with pride. I was a 4-H entomology student. Mm-hmm. And he put one in his collection. And he claims to have caught it in Kansas. It hasn't been verified yet that there's a population there. It's possible that it could have come off a train or something that was out there. That would be the furthest west that it's ever been confirmed. Currently, the furthest west that we know it to live is in Switzerland County, Indiana, though. Mm-hmm. That was the one that popped up in early summer last year. It's only about 3 miles from the Kentucky line. It's right across the Ohio River, basically. And they called us up to ask if we would come up and take a look. The Indiana DNR was the one that went out and confirmed it. And it was a lot of bugs. There was a ton of these invasive insects there. Just for some background, spotted lanternfly is related to cicadas. It's in the same group. So they both have these needle-like mouth parts that they suck juices out of plants in order to get their food. And these ones are just very good at it. They will eat from about 70 different types of plants. They love grapes. They love hops. So anybody that enjoys an adult beverage in the evening, this one would be a problem for you. They also get on a lot of our different fruits and vegetables when they're young, but they'll also attack hardwood plants. So they pose a big threat to our lumber industry here in Kentucky. I've talked to the Christmas tree growers about it because it gets on white pine. We've talked to the Kentucky maple syrup producers because it will suck the syrup out, basically, and ruin those plants. And we just don't want it here. It's a big quality of life issue, if I'm being frank. I don't know if you've seen any of the videos people from Pennsylvania and other places post online. Yeah, I see some nods.
Yes. Yeah,
so can you describe what you've seen?
No, I don't really know how to describe the one that I saw. I mean, it was – I don't even have words, to be honest.
Well, you know, you mentioned that Indiana had been the farthest west find so far. Talk a little bit about what has been the traditional home range of the spotted lanternfly.
So it's from Asia. It's an invasive pest from there, which that is an area of the world that we do a lot of international trade and travel with, of course. So we have received a few of these different invasive species from that neck of the woods. And the reason they do well here is because our climate matches up very well with portions of China and Japan and Korea. They're very similar temperatures, very similar climatic factors. So those bugs often thrive in places like Kentucky and other states in the United States. So that's where it's from. We have given as good as we've gotten in some cases. We've spread a few different things around the world as a nation. So I don't want to pick on them or anything, but yes, that's where it's from. Yeah.
Jonathan, educate us a little bit, or educate our listeners too, about how these invasive species move around the world. How does all this come about? You know, how does this happen?
Sure, absolutely. So a lot of the ones that we deal with in the entomology world, they come in on wooden packing material. A lot of them are larvae inside of the wood. So if you've ever seen those wooden shipping pallets that get sort of pushed to the side after they come off of a truck or off of a train, those sometimes do have larvae inside of them, or insects that are kind of hiding between the slats. In other cases, we have actually imported nursery goods, and then in the soil or on the plant surface itself, somebody missed an egg or a pupa, and then it gets through quarantine, or somebody snuck it in, and then you unleash havoc on the unsuspecting area, the sort of naive area where it's never been before. And then there's nothing there that eats it. There's no defenses in our plants that can protect them against it. When you have insects that develop with trees and crops for a long period of time, they sort of reach an equilibrium, for lack of a better term, sort of a Cold War detente almost, where they each have ways of attacking one another, where one can eat the plant, or the plant can develop something that will make the insect suffer and not be able to succeed on it as well. But we don't have that here. All of our plants would be naive from an Asian species that would arrive. We think with SLF, it probably came in on infested nursery stock that was purchased and then set out. And then they were able to either complete their egg development or pop out somehow and then get going. It's the same thing we saw with Japanese beetle over 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. We bought a bunch of iris bulbs, and the soil came with them, and in the soil were the grubs or the eggs. Yeah. And then those got dumped out, and then we had this big invasive species.
Do you remember the landing spot for that?
That's New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah. I think the first instance in Kentucky was around Louisville.
Okay.
I remember reading in 1920s, maybe.
That sounds
sometime
about right.
In that time frame.
Yeah.
I was watching something on Discovery Channel the other day about smuggling. You know, people smuggle stuff, and they had one of the port of entries. They actually had somebody that was checking the wooden pallets.
Yep, yeah.
About, you know, to see if there was anything in there. And, I mean, they were tearing those things apart and everything. I mean, it's pretty neat to see what they did.
We should be very proud that we have those procedures
absolutely.
In place.
I mean, you know, it makes perfect sense. When we talk, and this is something we've identified, you know, here in this state through the years, insects hitching rides on tractor trailers and going up and down the interstate, we have noticed damage along those corridors, you know.
Absolutely.
And known that that was a method of tracking them. It makes perfect sense that coming from other countries through normal shipping commerce, mm-hmm. that they would move the same way.
Yeah, and if you look at some of the history, like you mentioned Louisville, I mean, Port City on
Port
the river,
City, right.
Dragging stuff in and out of there. A lot of the first finds, they're in areas like that. Emerald ash borer started in Detroit. Some of these other ones in New Jersey and Philadelphia, places where we get a lot of stuff coming in. Florida is a big hot spot for this its climate, and then all of the different ports that are down there. We put a lot of effort, the USDA APHIS does at least, into monitoring that particular state to make sure things don't come in.
It was pretty neat to watch them. I mean, they even had like vegetables and things like that, and they were just completely tearing those boxes apart and looking, just spreading all that out, just looking for any kind of insects, invasive species, or
looking
anything.
For bugs.
Yeah.
It's, and when you mentioned the interstate sort of version of it, like what happens once they're here, spotted lanternfly is actually a really potent example of that. If you look at Pennsylvania, the first state that they invaded, you'll notice on the map there's kind of a straight line that goes across the state of infested.
I-80?
It's actually, there's a major railway there.
Okay.
And they found out that they were laying their eggs on these trains, and they hadn't really thought about that at the start of the invasion. And yeah, they just trucked them right along on these trains across the state. And after that, they've kind of matriculated out from that one line, it looks like. And those seem to be people, you know, driving in and out of these areas. One of the big problems with lanternfly is that the female, when she lays her eggs, she creates this, it looks like a mud smear. It looks almost like putty that you use for fixing up parts of your house. And her eggs are underneath of this smear epoxy that she produces. And for most insects, they lay their eggs on things that they want their young to feed on. These ones, they'll lay them anywhere, basically. They lay them on trees and things that they would feed on. They lay them on rocks, mailboxes, fence posts. They lay them on cars. So in that state, they sometimes inspect people that travel between counties. They get up under your wheel well, and they look to see if anybody's laid some egg patches under there. They look at the undercarriage. There's mirrors and things like that. Wow. And some of folks, I've seen pictures of, like, permits to be able to travel in and out of areas that say, you know, I got inspected. I'm hopefully not a spotted lanternfly carrier. But unfortunately, we aid these pests in a lot of ways when we do a lot of trade here.
I know in places like the far northeast, Maine, for instance, some places I've spent a lot of time, they have regular inspections of the log trucks that move back and forth up and down the corridor, up and down the 95 corridor, and then in and out of Canada coming back and forth.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, it warms my heart as an entomologist to hear that there's those kinds of inspections. I know not everybody enjoys government intervention and things like that, or intrusions into our lives, but we do want to try and keep a handle on some of these bugs, lanternfly in particular, just because some of those videos that, like you, Vicky, were talking about that you just can't describe. I mean, you just see trees that they're more bug than tree. There's just insects all over them. You can watch people rake their hands through it. It looks like a fear factor thing or something.
It really does. Yeah. I mean, it's stacked up, and I mean, it's
thousands of these insects just sucking sap out of the tree, which will ooze sap after they feed on it. They look kind of wilty and drought stricken because they're basically having their blood stolen by all of these bugs. It's almost like a tick in that way. And then as they do this, they poop out a lot of sugary material, and they don't digest everything. So there's this honeydew, that was what we call it, that just accumulates on the ground, on the plant. That recruits black sooty mold. It smells like a distillery, sort of, when you get near these sites that are infested, just sort of fermenting, a little foul. And then it attracts bees and flies that want to drink this up. And there's stories from Pennsylvania of honeybee colonies. They stop foraging properly on flowers. They just start drinking all this lanternfly diarrhea, and it ruins the honey, basically.
Wow.
Yeah, it's astonishing. It's weird how these invasives can leak out from the primary problem that they cause, feeding on a plant, and then all of these other things that can just pop up with them, ruining quality of life. People fall down. They slip on this stuff that's very slippery, the honeydew. And it's just not fun to be around. So they don't go to their backyard anymore.
So this putty that you mentioned, you know, when they lay the eggs, I mean, I'm assuming that's to protect the eggs. That's the reason for it to have that kind of consistency, covering whatever the word
you're
is.
You're exactly correct.
Your
intuition is right on. The eggs are the overwintering stage. And this is one of the ways that they have been able to survive so well as a pest here, is that the mother covers most of the eggs up with this. So they've actually taken measurements of covered and uncovered eggs. And I want to say it's like a 40 or 50% improvement on your survival rate with winter temperatures. It protects them from the cold air. Just this thin layer of insect-produced material, it makes sure that they survive at a higher rate.
That just amazes me. It's like, how do they know to do that?
It's amazing.
I mean, it really is when you think about it. I mean,
they've
probably
developed those over time, these practices that they have, or whatever, how you want to.
Well, yeah, there's selection pressure for this to occur. Yeah. I mean, and we see it even with native pests, for example, like bagworms. Bagworm eggs, they stay inside with their mom of the bag over the winter. She dies, and then they're trapped in there with her, and they're covered up by her body as well as the bag. And it just keeps it like 2 degrees warmer, maybe, inside of that bag. And insects have to reach a lethal temperature for a certain amount of time. And if that clock gets reset at all, then they would have to refreeze them, basically. And yeah, we see these adaptations where it's just like this razor thin margin where the insect is able to survive being exposed to something that would normally kill it.
That's interesting.
It is.
You had mentioned off the air some of the other invasive species that we've kind of encountered during 2021. Talk a little bit about the brown marmorated stink bug. I know out here in this part of the state, that's something that not only did we you know, get a lot of calls as agents from folks who have them in their houses. I saw damage in soybeans and some other related problems that they'd brought about in production related issues.
I was about to flip the table a little bit and ask you what like level of questions you got, but you kind of answered it for me.
We've got the telepathy
it's,
thing.
Maybe
going
it's the headphones. Like it all feeds
the beard.
That's the beard. You're right.
That's what it is.
Extension.
Now here now. Here now.
Brown marmorate is definitely something we are keeping a close eye on. It's something that's been in the state for a little while, but the western half of the state seems to be our last invaded for a lot of these different pests, and it's expanding its range out into here from 19 into 20 and 21. I think we've added like 10 or 12 counties first detections, and then you get into the year two or three after they're first found, and that's when you start to kind of link up on the roller coaster. It starts to move you up. Invasives, they often go through this cycle where nobody notices it for about 3 years, and then all of a sudden everybody starts asking questions, and then year four and five and six, you go to the peak of the roller coaster. They're annoying everybody. It's destroying things, and then you kind of go down on the other side, and after about 10 years, you get this fallout where it kind of dissipates for a little while, and then you go through these up and down cycles. We see it with Japanese beetle and a few others.
Japanese beetle was the very thing I was thinking
of. Yeah, we go through these boom and bust cycles. But that's not a comforting thing to hear when you're going up the roller coaster. So that's where y'all are here in Western Kentucky, is that things will get worse here over the next couple of years. They do feed on a variety of crops. There's a group called StopBMSB.org, and you can see on their website, they have this really cool chart that shows all of the crops that are most impacted by this insect. And if you look, it's things like apples, and grapes, peppers, redbud trees, sweet corn, tomatoes all get attacked very heavily. They will also feed less preferentially, though, on like things, cucumbers, cherries, broccoli, blueberries, and asparagus. And then we don't see them on potatoes and turnips and carrots and sweet potatoes, which you might notice as underground
tubers.
Right.
Yeah, so
right.
They can't get to the thing that we want to eat anyway. They do get into fields. They cause damage on soybeans. We are hopeful that in the near future, there will be an insect that infiltrates our state that's called the samurai wasp. It is a biocontrol organism that attacks BMSB, but we can't release it purposefully in the state because it also could impact some native species of stink bug, which I doubt breaks a lot of people's hearts, but that means that the USDA won't allow you to buy them and rear them and then release them. But it is making its way around the country kind of on its own. It appeared in the U.S. on its own. It was actually probably brought over around the same time that the stink bug was in some of the eggs. So the female wasp lays her eggs inside of the stink bug eggs. They turn black because the baby wasp is in there eating the baby stink bug, basically. And I don't know why they're called samurai wasps necessarily. I've never seen a sword with any of them. But they do destroy a lot of these stink bugs. They're in Ohio. We're hopeful that they'll start to trickle down into this state and we'll see some suppression. It is very potent biocontrol agent. They knock a lot of them out. But if you are waiting for that, you'll want to think about looking at the edges of fields, like soybean fields in particular. Think about treating those edges, especially if they're near forested spots, because those edges are where they like to live. They like to be able to move back and forth. So a pyrethroid in those spots, after some scouting with a net, you would be able to go out and make those sprays and treat them.
I think it's interesting, too, that you brought up the beneficial insects because, you know, outside of entomologists, there's a lot of people that just don't like any creepy crawlies. You'll hear that term, you know, I just don't want any creepy crawlies. I don't like that. And, you know, but there are some really good beneficial insects that we do need to keep around. And you know, and when we think about that, then – you know, thinking about those, you know, insecticides that we're using and timing of when we're using some of those to try to make sure that we are controlling what we need to control, but hopefully, you know, not hurting that our beneficial insects that we really rely on so much.
Absolutely. I mean, we want to keep those natural enemies around, those things that eat the pests. We want to keep pollinators safe and hardy and healthy. We do a lot of that with IPM, of course, this integrated approach to pest management, or by choosing to use more selective products or products that are kind of contained inside of a plant. If you look at corn, I mean, BT is a revelation, right?
Right.
It keeps a very specific toxin inside of the plant. We're not exposing broad swaths of the environment to an insecticide spray. So when you have those kinds of innovations happening in pest control, I think it's a really great setup for the future where hopefully we'll just keep going in those kinds of directions where it's less about spraying large scale and more about using a systemic product or using something that has very specific activity. There's lots of those new insecticides.
And even on the homeowner front, like on your gardening and stuff, is sometimes it's just a matter of adjusting when you make your application, yep. too, especially when you're talking about, you know, our honeybee populations, just kind of paying attention to that and maybe adjusting when you make an application.
Yeah, bees are definitely, they're around at the high point of the day, of course. So if you go out and make an application midday, or if your plants are in bloom, you're going to be exposing them. I actually did a lot of my graduate work on how to reduce problems in lawns. So I think a lot of people forget that a dandelion and a clover, those are flowers. Right. There's about 50 different species of pollinating insects that visit those. And if you treat with an insecticide over the top of those, they end up getting exposed pretty frequently. So getting rid of those blooms, trying to time things, even just avoiding them in the same day that you make the application, all definitely help.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's you know, when you're talking about dandelions and things of this in people's yards, you know, that's something that's real important. That is a timing of application, and a lot of those things can be taken care of before they ever bloom.
It's absolutely,
you know, and so yeah. So as producers and as homeowners, we need to think about that stuff because, you know, this bee thing is pretty serious.
That's absolutely true.
You know,
yeah.
and we need to really pay attention to what we're doing from that standpoint.
And ag producers, I mean, it's the same thing that you see with hunting, right? These are the people that are invested in the success of these animals, so they do a lot. They invest a lot of time and effort into making sure that they help. I always get very frustrated when I hear negative things about ag and pollinators. I mean, mm-hmm. those producers are trying their best to do the right thing. I mean, they make the choices to buy more expensive products in some cases or change their practices because their success is tied up in a bee's success as well. Yeah, so
that's, right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yep. I didn't know I was going to get to go on a pollinator talk tonight. Too, but I like that we're kind of threading the needle on all these things.
Well, so then you know, the thing about it is pollinators are that important, and we should be introducing that discussion whenever we can.
Good point.
Same thing with when we think about, you were mentioning the predatory insects. You know, when we make just, I'll say, errant spray applications, we're affecting them just as much as we are the targeted species. So it sounds like they have a typical predator-prey type relationship, and we need to be encouraging all of those beneficials as we can.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of research going into how you can intercrop or use multiple types of plants in an environment, or how can we recruit these things. You know, you never know what's going to happen in the future, like what may be required of agriculture, the practices that may have to change. There's less and less land there. I mean, what's fuel right now for agriculture producers to go out and buy?
We don't even want to talk about that today.
And insecticide prices are going up with supply chain issues. So, I mean, there's an opportunity. You can look at it one of two ways, right? It's all problems. It's all headaches, or it's an opportunity to find these new methods or change these practices. And in some cases, those end up benefiting these non-target organisms we're talking about, too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and last fall, some of the things that we kind of ran into is the armyworm. Worm.
Yes.
Talk with us a little bit about how that all went.
So fall armyworm was definitely the bug of 2021. I mean, it ate the whole state of Kentucky. It basically ate the eastern United States, if we're honest. For this state, it's a migratory pest. It can't survive here over the winter. We deal with it every year. It shows up in the state. It's a big problem usually for corn and alfalfa producers. But last year, it popped out of those arenas, ended up in home lawns and sports fields as well. We just had huge, huge numbers of this pest showing up. So basically, there's all these questions about why did that happen? Like, why did we get this outbreak of them? Our data from our friends at Auburn University says it was the worst year since 1977 for fall armyworm. We do trapping, and it starts in the western portion of the state. So Princeton, the traps usually reveal fall armyworm getting here, I think, the second week of June. And then last year, they got here the first week of May. And they were in force, like in numbers. Yeah. And it turned out that they had done really well further north than normal. Their normal overwintering habitat is like the southern tips of Florida and Texas. That's where they survive in the U.S. But it was warmer further north, so they got a head start that way. There was a lot of spring rains. They prefer that kind of wet spring environment. It makes their food grow better. It helps them survive better. So there were more of them in the south. And then we had a couple of hurricanes that blew up into the state, if you remember. And it actually carried some of these moths here more rapidly than we're used to. So they got a head start, and they exploded in the state. I don't know about you all, but I was getting dozens of images a day of like thousands of egg masses being laid on people's houses and pools and everything else. This was right after the spotted lanternfly find, and the egg cases look sort of similar in a picture from far away. So we got very frightened at first, but then we figured out what it was. And then they just came out and they ate everything. Yeah. And it's one of those things, you all are in extension, you know, you try to get the word out early about monitoring and going out and looking for it, but people often don't notice the damage until it's too late or the caterpillar's too big. So we were playing a lot of catch up. We were trying to teach people about pyrethroid usage, so bifenthrin, lambda cyhalothrin, things like that.
And it was so erratic. Right. You know, in the thing you would see, like on Facebook and stuff, you would see that one person's yard would be completely eaten up, and the next person's yard wouldn't be touched.
So
it was very erratic, that kind of way. You know?
I mean, that can come down to turf species that's growing in there. It can also come down to, we actually had some really cool revelations that people who had used a product called Acelaprin or Scott's Grub-X, which has a different chemical than in other lawn applications in particular, which is usually imidacloprid. Those are all for grubs typically, but Acelaprin works actually throughout the season and gets caterpillars, and it was at high enough levels in a lot of these plants, even late in the season, like end of August, that, yeah, there were a lot of yards and golf courses saved because they treated for grubs around Mother's Day, and there was still product in there to wipe out these fall armyworms as they came through.
That's pretty interesting, just because it was so erratic, and I saw some pictures of some lawns that were just devastated. And then the next, like the yard next to them was just, it's fine.
My favorite was when I'd get those and it just, you know, it's just dirt. And there's like little nubs of grass. They're like, what do I spray? It's like, I don't know, man. Like, you're just out for revenge at that point. You might as well just
start over.
Yeah, just get some new grass.
Yeah, just start over.
An early application like you're talking about probably had an effect on Japanese beetle issues last year as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah. The Japanese beetles are the main grub that we're targeting when we make those applications for sure. We have seen a reduction in Japanese beetle the last few years. I have not seen as many in the state of Kentucky as I was expecting when I came back. It's a pest that, like I said, goes up and down, but I think we've had a couple of weird springs in a row that have impacted them. I know last year I went out to make my first samples for some grubs and some billbug problems. It was like the end of April, April 20th, thereabout maybe. And I had to scrape snow off the top of it, which was unexpected. And we've had some weird wetness that pops up. And that can kill out some of the grubs that are overwintering for that species in particular. So Kentucky weather is so unique. The climate here is so cool, just that transitional zone status. It means that we end up with unique problems and unique appearances of problems where normally we would expect certain things at certain times of year based on other states' data. But then when we get here, everything's so kind of higgly-piggly sometimes that we get these weird phenologies where things pop up when we don't expect it.
We're definitely on the edge. Yeah. I mean, we catch a lot of those things that aren't far enough north to end and or aren't far enough south to end.
Exactly, yeah.
So what do we have to look forward to in 2022?
Good question. I will read the tarot cards and see what we have. I'm thinking that it's kind of been wet, it feels like, so far. Maybe we're heading into another cool, wet spring and early summer, so people should keep an eye out for slugs. I have heard from Raul Villanueva, our entomologist in Princeton, that slugs have been a big problem in this half of the state.
It has been a huge problem.
Yeah, big problem last year.
Yeah, and back a few, I forget now how many years ago, you know, it's like...
Several.
Yeah. We had it's like you just didn't ever hear of it, and all of a sudden it was a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And it's just a lot of replanting that year. I mean, it was just, not panic, but I mean, it just came out of nowhere, and then... You know, you didn't hear from it anything, any issues for a couple of years until last year.
And I think it was pretty unexpected last year.
So, I had issues with them on late into the season with some late planted cantaloupes I had issues in the garden. So, personally.
So, corn and soybeans here, like big ag, and then home garden stuff, it sounds like just about everything under the sun, probably.
Anything that was on the ground, basically, you would have had that issue in the garden.
Yep. You can try to avoid it sort of temporally in the field, like if you're talking corn and soybeans, if you go out later and later, if you push that planting date, you can avoid some of this weather that fuels them, this cool, wet spring weather. So you can avoid them that way. You can disc down about 3 inches and destroy a lot of their overwintering habitat and places that they hide. it's really hard in a big ag setting to do some of the treatment plans that we would advocate for with slugs. Usually you're talking about diatomaceous earth, or you're talking about some sort of slug bait, but that's very pricey at the acreages that we're talking about. So the disking, the insecticide options are not really present. A 7 bait, like a carbaryl bait, can help if you can afford it and if you can get it applied. But in the home garden, you can do diatomaceous earth. You can do those other small-scale things. You can even use beer traps on slugs. They love cheap beer. Mm-hmm. So drink one for you, drink one for them, pour one out for them.
Is there another kind?
So that's one thing I'm kind of wondering about out here in particular. BMSB, the stink bug, it's just going to get worse. I know that people have been talking a lot about it in their homes out here. I've gotten some of those phone calls back east in Lexington as well. So I think that you need to buckle up for another year of problems in the field. And then next winter, probably a lot of them coming into the home and being very annoying as well. Do some pest proofing as you get into the late summer. Seal up any holes in your caulking, all those kinds of things that keep bugs and problems out. Sometimes a perimeter spray helps. Other times they crawl right through it. You miss the timing where that you needed to get them. They'll hang out on the house too. So you can, if you look on your south and west facing side, that's where they're usually going to cluster first. And when you see them doing that, just spray them with soapy water, and that kills a whole bunch of them before they can get into your home.
It seems like they're just not, you know, I think the thing that has caught most people, especially when you're talking about homeowners, is it's just like they've never gone away. It's like you'll see them, you might see one today or, you know, where, you know, sometimes, you know, especially with the Asian ladybugs, I mean, it's like you won't see them until you have a warm day exactly. or two, and then then you see them. And I think homeowners are kind of used to that, you know, but I think they were this having these stink bugs and seeing them all year. They didn't like that very much.
No. It seems to be very annoying. I got hit in the face while I was brushing my teeth the other day in my house. So they don't even respect entomologists at all. So yeah, I can only imagine.
I had somebody in my county that, you know, they said, you know, these things, I can't even eat my pancakes. You know, yeah. It's like they were eating breakfast and looks down and then there's one. You know, like, forget it. You know, yeah, what's happening?
Yeah, that kind of rolls us into our timely tip, too. And it goes for homeowners as well as folks in agriculture. Regular field scouting of crops is the best way to stay ahead of pest challenges during the upcoming growing season. Jonathan, you have anything to add about that?
Scouting is foundational to any pest control. You got to be out there looking for the bugs. I know we do a lot of preventive sprays where we treat and kind of spray and pray, where you hope that whatever you've bought or whatever you've done is going to last for the season. But you can go out and actually monitor for them directly, set up traps, follow trap data online. The Kentucky Pest News blog is great for that. They post all that trap data very frequently. So just doing that monitoring is definitely going to keep you ahead of the game.
You know, I think that's a good place to plug our Kentucky Pest News. For folks out there that want that information, contact your local extension office and get on their email list. I know the agents would be glad to send you that. It's a wonderful publication that we get that yourself and everybody else weighs into for getting information out to us. And it's the Kentucky Pest News is one of the best things I feel like we have in our system for keeping your thumb on the pulse of that in season type changes and staying on top of things.
Warms my heart to hear. Thank you for
there
that.
You go.
And also, you were talking about the trapping numbers and all of that. That information is also, if I recall correctly, at the bottom of that newsletter,
right.
It's got the numbers, you know, the trapping numbers. So that's interesting to see, too, and can follow that.
It's, you know, it may be above the level that some folks want to read, especially maybe the homeowner, but it's good information just the same and information that everybody needs to know. So good deal, good tip. Well, we want to thank Dr. Jonathan Larson for being with us, making the trip down from Lexington. We're glad you came down for the training, but we're glad were able to take time and sit down with us as well. And want to thank our hosts for helping to bring this show out. And we want to thank our listeners who joined in, and we hope you'll make plans to join in with us again next week. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.